Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sandy, day two. It's time to add up all the damage. Using all the new money in politics to keep track of the candidates. And use the force. Walt. Disney is buying Star Wars, believe it or not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 30th of October. Good to have you with us. $20 billion seems to be the ballpark figure for the damage that Sandy leaves behind. As always, the early numbers are subject to change, but you never do really hear them being changed lower, do you? Half or less of the $20 billion will be covered by insurance policies. Companies, governments, and you and me are on the hook for the rest of it. From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
Sandy may end up one of America's five costliest storms, though the runaway winner, Katrina, carried a price tag north of $100 billion, at least double this disaster. A big wallop this time is business interruption. Buying, selling, shipping, and manufacturing that didn't happen. I Skyped IHS Global Insight economist Greg Dayko. His phone line is out in Boston. He's bummed that Sandy came on a business day.
Hence, its impact is very likely to be much more severe than that of Hurricane Irene, which had a similar trajectory in 2011 but hit us on a Sunday.
Big companies insure against disruptions, not small ones, or hourly workers. Chuck Watson is with the hazard research firm Kinetic Analysis.
If they're not working, they're not getting paid. They may make some of it back in overtime, but for the most part, that's just lost wages for them. You throw in maybe some child care because school's out, and you've got a lot of stress on people that are just getting by and on your medium and small businesses.
Also on the hook, governments. They own the subways, roads, bridges, and street signs that need fixing.
Local officials are faced with a real dilemma. Do you raise taxes? Maybe that pothole in front of the high school doesn't get filled in for an extra month or two, or maybe there's a program that you don't expand.
As for homeowners, insurance covers wind damage, but not flood coverage. If they have it, Washington picks up most of that tab. Watson thinks private insurers will get more and more out of catastrophes in general. So a piece of the rock will be a smaller piece of the pie when it comes to disasters. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Sandy left plus or minus 7 million people without power in the greater Northeast. That's a lot of people desperate to charge their smartphones and computers and all the rest of their gear. Our own Dan Bobkoff is among the nomads looking for a working power outlet.
People don't usually say this about me, but I'm power hungry. I haven't had electricity since 1:30 Monday afternoon. To power my smartphone, I first tried the crank radio I got for donating to a public radio pledge drive. It's supposed to charge it, but that didn't work out so well. And it says charging is not supported with this accessory. So I resorted to an overpriced generator, my car. Ah, the sounds of electrons flowing. This feels incredibly wasteful. About 2 million people in New York State alone are without power, and many of those are on the move in search of electricity. My colleagues in Manhattan came across Will Wheeler and his roommates from the Lower East Side. They found salvation outside a Midtown building.
A couple of banks had them, but we just found the base of a tree that had an outlet that was working.
Yes, he said a tree. His group is running an extension cord from the outlet to charge a MacBook, 5 iPhones, and a BlackBerry. At the New Yorker Hotel on 34th Street, powerless nomads packed the lobby and plugged into every outlet. Kim Garrett is a nurse who left her downtown apartment before dawn.
I just took my flashlight, my devices, my cords, my rain boots, my raincoat, and just headed north and kept walking until I found somewhere that might have a plug. And this, the New Yorker Hotel was the first one.
She says she got lucky. She even found a chair. In Brooklyn, Ethan Gould rigged this together.
It's 8 AA batteries in a configuration hooked up to 2 solar panels, which can then be attached to USB cables or also iPhone chargers.
I don't have anything that fancy. I'm just waiting for crews to clear the trees blocking my street. Stranded in Westchester County, New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
We've been collecting stories from people in the storm. Here's one from Maryland. Pat Warner is a Waffle House executive. He says they're staying open.
Our issues right now are power. We have a couple families just come in that hadn't eaten, so they came in and we're on a limited menu on what we can cook, but we are open and cooking, though we're eating by candlelight. You know, those families that we saw today, they need a place to eat right after a storm. Our associates need, you know, get back to work and start earning money, because obviously they've been impacted by the storm as well. And if we're shut down, they're not making any money.
Tell us your stories on our Facebook page. Works best. On Wall Street today. Oh, wait. Never mind. Sorry to have to be the one to tell you this, especially the Star Wars purists among you, but there's going to be a Star Wars Episode 7 movie coming out in a couple of years. We know that because Disney told us so today. At the same time, they announced they're going to spend $4 billion to buy Lucasfilm, as in George Lucas, the guy who made the first six Star Wars movies. Sharon Waxman is the CEO and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. It's a blog that covers Hollywood and entertainment. Hey, Sharon.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so why?
Why'd they buy it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really big purchase. what they're saying, and what makes a lot of sense, is that Disney is pursuing a strategy of buying big entertainment brands and then monetizing those brands across all of the different divisions of their company.
All right. So, I mean, I get that, and that's mm-hmm. It makes total sense. However, hasn't this franchise been wrung out like all the way?
I don't think so.
Really?
And I really don't think so. I mean, I would bet that Star Wars is still throwing off a couple of $100 million
wow.
a year, even now, just, you know, by new fans and old fans. It makes a lot of money still in licensing and consumer products, sheets, lightsabers never go out of fashion.
I think that's
what they're talking about. I just got off the call in which Bob Iger and Jay Rasulo, the CFO of Disney, were talking about how they calculated out of a $4 billion valuation for a company that is wholly owned by George Lucas. That's
right.
A big number.
Right. So how did they get there? They obviously believe they're going to make all their money back.
Yeah. Well, they're going to be making, you just alluded to it, new Star Wars films. And what's interesting is, so the next one, which would be Star Wars 7, will come out in 2015, and then they're already planning for number 8 and number 9, with or without Jar Jar Binks would be the biggest question for me personally, but that's just me. And if they're planning that every 2-3 years, they can kind of figure out what that franchise is likely to do. They just said, you know, they were conservative in their valuation, but they're adding in 3D, so we can expect 3D Star Wars movies, which shouldn't be a total shock. But if you look at a franchise that came out of their acquisition of Marvel, for example, in 2009, for which they also spent $4 billion.
The Avengers, right? Yeah.
The Avengers, that's right. The last Avengers movie brought in $1.5 billion worldwide in box office, right?
Yeah, so now they've got Pixar as well. I mean, they're racking up Disney's racking up quite the set of studios here.
Yeah, they're like having trophy wives.
you've been in Hollywood too long. Is the revenue that they're hoping to make off of this thing gonna replace softness elsewhere? I mean, how's ABC doing in some of their other properties?
Well, I mean, the real huge drivers at Disney are television and cable specifically.
Yeah.
It's, you know, ESPN is this monster that throws off all this money. And so one of the interesting things is kind of wither movies in general, in a way, because they just seem to keep shrinking and shrinking the numbers of movies that the major studios are making. They're making at Disney now four to six live-action movies a year. That's got to be a third of the to a quarter of the numbers that they were making 10 years ago.
Hmm.
But some of them are coming from DreamWorks, and they've got others coming from Marvel, some coming from Pixar.
Yeah.
So they can get back to 18 movies a year. But I think that the real aim here is not just to bet on the movie studio, but to bet on a brand that they're going to be able to.
Yeah. All right. Sharon Waxman from The Wrap. We got to go. Thank you so much, Sharon.
You're welcome.
See ya. I know they say this every 4 years, but this time it might actually be true that this presidential election is different, that this is the one that's going to change everything. Although, it's entirely possible that the conventional wisdom about why it's different is wrong, that it's actually different in part because of this guy and people like him.
I came here because part of my job is to film, if possible, everything Mitt Romney does, every handshake he has, every word that comes out of his mouth when he's in Iowa, him or his surrogates.
That's Will Urquhart. He's 28. He's been out on the campaign trail since May of last year, 2011. And that thing he just said about capturing every word that comes out of Mitt Romney's mouth, that's pretty much his whole job description.
We want to just know what he's saying, both good and bad, everything. And then, of course, you know, we want to find any time that he says something that is either contradictory to something he said in the primary.
Will's what you call a campaign tracker, just like it sounds. He and hundreds of other trackers just like him working for both parties follow candidates wherever they go, hoping for that gaffe, that unscripted moment, anything that can be used in an ad or a YouTube video. Even if you've never heard of trackers, chances are you know their work.
This fella here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere.
That right there was a campaign tracker's dream. Virginia Republican Senator George Allen back in 2006 calling one of the Democratic operatives shadowing him that slur, Makaka. It took Allen right out of that race. And in this campaign, 2012, you can't turn around without hearing what trackers do.
Mitt Romney paid only 14% in taxes.
Barack Obama, failing American workers.
Outsourcing jobs, taking down the flag.
Cutting early reading programs.
What would you do if these were your children?
There's a huge amount of new money pouring into this campaign. It's a direct result of the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United, the case that said companies and unions can spend essentially as much as they want on politics. I spent a good part of the summer working on a project with Frontline, a documentary that's going to air on public television tonight, trying to figure out what all that money looks like in this election.
So where are we?
So we are about to enter what we call our war room.
Yeah.
It's not what you would think. It actually has windows. It's very spacious.
Part of that money looks like this, the war room of a Democratic super PAC called American Bridge 21st Century. It's the one our tracker Will Urquhart works for.
I mean, we're standing inside a super PAC now, right?
You're standing inside a super PAC, but not your typical super PAC.
Kind of looks like those shots of the control rooms you see behind network anchors on TV. Lots of people busily working in front of dozens of oversized monitors.
So what are these people doing?
So most of the people in this room are researchers.
This looks for all the world like a bunch of kids sitting around surfing the web.
For the most part, yeah. But they are very smart kids, and they know what they're looking for. And they are pretty much uncovering things about candidates that those candidates would rather the American people not know.
American Bridge is part of the post-Citizens super PAC boom. It's only been around since November 2010. It's smaller than some of the other super PACs out there. It's raised about $8.5 million since June. But as American Bridge President Rodel Molyneux told me, it's powerful because of what it does.
Now, this is mostly public information. You just need to know where to look at it. And what you do is you put together the political history of a candidate, every vote that they've ever taken, every political statement that they had made, any contradictions that you might find.
Researching and tracking Republican candidates, staffers pour over hundreds of hours of video. They scroll back and forth, switching between monitors, until they find just what they're looking for.
So this woman here, what's she doing here?
Okay. So I think what Audrey's doing here...
There is a little bit of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to this whole thing, if you think about it.
These are the people who come up with the research that you're going to find in the direct mail piece, in the 30-second ad, in the online ad. That happens here.
Just by observing something, tracking it, you change it. Republican congressional staffer James Cartenson explains.
I think for people that are advising candidates, it's a nightmare where it becomes a bad thing. And in the era of gotcha politics that's ever evolving and increasing, is taking two words of a speech and turning that into an attack ad. And that's where it makes any campaign advisor or official or media guy have their hair gray up and lose it overnight.
Gotcha politics isn't the only criticism that trackers get. More than four dozen members of the House of Representatives from both sides of the aisle complained publicly this summer. The trackers, to them, felt more like stalkers.
Get here and stay downtown and get to have a bite to
back at the rally in Des Moines, tracker Will Urquhart is still recording.
Enjoy the fine
food and the
following the candidate along the rope line.
Beautiful young lady. Hi, how are you doing today? Good.
Scuffling with campaign staffers, too.
Stop pushing me. Stop pushing me. I didn't start pushing you.
And then...
So now I'm done with my debrief. I'm actually going to turn my phone on as a modem for my computer so I can submit it so I don't have to run to like a Starbucks or some other coffee shop with internet.
From the front seat of his car, Will sends his report and his video back to American Bridge, back to that war room we were in earlier. And some technical glitches aside...
Oh, crap.
It's all uploaded in less than an hour. Then American Bridge dumps everything into a searchable database. If it's worthy, it'll go on their website or on YouTube or out to the media. And eventually, in an ad or a news story or in a stump speech, out to you. Our collaboration with Frontline about the effects of hidden money on American politics that we've been doing on the radio all this month comes to a head on public television tonight. It's a documentary I did called Big Sky, Big Money. Tonight, PBS. Check your local listings. Coming up...
If you have to ask, it's usually racist.
Applies to Halloween costumes, too, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, another day off for Wall Street, except for testing the trading systems at the New York Stock Exchange. That's ahead of tomorrow's reopening. The exchange made it official this afternoon. Exchange officials do now say, by the way, they have backup generators and 40 hours worth of fuel should the need arise. New York subway system won't be able to reboot as quickly as the stock market has. It will take 4 to 5 days to resume service. New Jersey commuter trains to New York could take 7 to 10 days to return to the tracks. I managed to fly home this morning from North Carolina, but from the second day in a row, airlines in the U.S. canceled more than 7,000 flights. Global markets were open today, and Europe did manage to rebound. London's FTSE added nearly 1%. France's CAC 40 jumped 1.5%. The German DAX gained 1.1%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei fell 1% on the nose, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday, Halloween. Are things getting back to normal? The New York Stock Exchange is scheduled to get back to trading. He was a difficult man to lock up. On October 31st, 1926, magician and escape artist Harry Houdini died. And it is widely held that candy is bad for children. Concerned about that? Take it away from them. Eat it yourself. Sacrifice builds character. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. So yes, parts of LaGuardia Airport in New York are in fact underwater. Tunnels into and out of Manhattan and parts of the subway system in the city are flooded. The floor of the New York Stock Exchange, however, is dry and, fingers crossed, gonna be open for business tomorrow. That's the plan. The Big Board's electronic exchange will carry the load if anything goes wrong, which is a good thing because tomorrow is not just any old trading day. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story from New York.
Wednesday is an important day to get markets going again, not, of course, because it's Halloween.
Tomorrow, October 31st, is the end of the month, and a lot of large institutions will want to make sure that they're properly positioned at the month end.
That's Paul Rawati of Tab Group. That October 401k statement you'll be getting depends on what happens tomorrow. That's just one reason Mark Lipson expects ample activity on Wall Street. He's a business professor at University of Virginia.
Combined with a flow of news related to the storm and all that pent-up information that still is being digested on business, there's going to be a lot of people very interested in establishing positions.
Baruch College professor Bernard Doniffer predicts light trading.
We may see a very strange kind of low-volume day.
He says some traders won't engage. Power and transit problems mean some physically can't. Other investors will hang back, waiting out an uncertain market. Whether trading can be frenzied or subdued depends on exchanges actually functioning. This is the first two-day weather closing since 1888, which sounds pretty dramatic. But remember, markets do this dozens of times a year. As USC Business School professor Larry Harris points out, it's called the weekend.
We close our markets every week for 2 days and reopen them without any difficulty at all. We'll reopen them after 4 days without much difficulty either.
Tomorrow won't be a normal trading day, but in one sense, it's just back to business after a long, weird weekend. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
I don't mind telling you the airline gods have been smiling on me. I got into the East Coast on Sunday, North Carolina, to be clear, and then out again this morning without even a hint of a delay. A whole bunch, hundreds of thousands of people probably haven't been so lucky. Tens of thousands of flights have been canceled. Major hubs have been closed for 2 days now. And even when they open back up again, getting air travel back to normal could take a whole lot longer, as Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
More than 14,000 flights were canceled yesterday and today. That means planes aren't where they're supposed to be, crews aren't where they're supposed to be, and passengers are all over the place. It's a mess, says airline analyst Robert Mann.
Well, you have the unusual circumstance of a disruption of essentially all the East Coast. That affects both international flights as well as domestic hub activity.
And those aren't the only challenges for the airlines.
They're operating on the edge, kind of day in and day out.
Kurt Grimm teaches supply chain management at the University of Maryland. He says the airlines have cut so much fat out of the system, when something goes wrong, it's hard for them to be flexible.
All slack in the system has long since been eliminated. I think that's one of the factors that makes it so difficult for them to rebound.
Grimm says another problem is that airlines have cut flights, and now planes are typically around 85% full, so it can be hard to find room for displaced passengers. Bob McAdoo is an airline analyst at Imperial Capital. He says the real issue in getting planes back in the air is on the ground.
So many of the people who work at the airport need public transit to get to work.
With the New York subway system shut down, McAdoo says a lot of crucial airport and security workers won't be able to get to their jobs.
The airport may be open for flights, but if the TSA can't get all of their people out there to work, they're not going to let any passengers go on a flight.
Right now, officials estimate it could be weeks before New York has regular subway service again. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
More stories from the storm now. Here's one out of Brooklyn.
The high tide flooded my street and rapidly rose. I spent the night without power, and then I began cleaning my first floor apartment this morning, and I've ever since been putting out essentially everything I own onto the sidewalk because it's been damage beyond repair. And my apartment may actually be uninhabitable, so I don't know if I can even stay here.
Joshua Rutter from the Red Hook neighborhood in Brooklyn. Tell us your story at our Facebook page. This is a free country, right? So you can dress up like anything you want for Halloween. Doesn't always mean it's a good idea, though. Youth Radio's Malachi Seegers has that story.
60 seconds. That's how long it took me to find this.
Oh, whoa, here's one. Mexican man. Just putting the name right out there. Includes sombrero, mustache, and poncho.
That's right. The Halloween costume was actually called Mexican Man. I asked shopper Marisol Rodriguez, who happens to be Mexican-American, is this weird?
I find it offensive when folks, especially privileged people, walk around being a Mexican for a day and not really knowing all the social issues that come along with that.
I found lots of borderline insulting costumes in the store. Native American get-ups with beads and feathers, slinky geisha outfits, afros and high-top fades, and an entire section of pimp costumes, some of which I showed to customer Leah Aguilera.
So we have costumes like Super Mac Daddy, Deluxe Afro Wig, you know, stuff like that. Like, how do you feel about these costumes?
Well, I'm a teacher. I think that it promotes stereotypes, not positive stereotypes.
Leading up to Halloween, Aguilera asked her third grade students to consider one thing before choosing a costume.
What image are you projecting?
And that's one of the questions I had for costume giant Spirit Halloween.
Spirit Halloween is the largest Halloween specialty retailer on the planet.
I asked company spokesperson Crystal Baxter what it means to sell a costume called, and I kid you not, Pimpin' Da Hose.
It's Halloween, and it's a trend that the customers want, and it's the one day a year that you can dress up and be whoever you want.
But don't they play on stereotypes and kind of further those stereotypes?
I'm sorry, I have to take a break.
Baxter referred me to Spirit's legal department for any further questions. And while yes, I have lots of questions about how to avoid insulting people on Halloween, legal is not likely to help. So I picked up the phone.
This is Andrew.
Andrew T. runs the blog, Yo, Is This Racist?
If you have to ask, it's usually racist.
But even T gets it wrong sometimes.
I'm Asian, and I thought it would be really funny to order from the internet, essentially like a racist Charlie Chan costume, telling people I was a quote-unquote Chinaman.
T says he wore it to be ironic, trying to call attention to the blatantly racist costume. But many people at the Halloween party thought he was mocking Asian people.
I realized then that sometimes that kind of satire can go over people's head and really give you the exact opposite result of what you were hoping for.
Okay, so Halloween is not about nuance, which is exactly why my colleague Ike Shrieskandaraja argues not to overthink things.
Oh, it gets tough. If we have to be racially specific, like to constrain ourselves to our own heritage for Halloween, I don't know what Sri Lankan historical figure I'm going to be.
Halloween can get complicated quickly. Perhaps the best piece of advice I've heard is to think ahead. Like, try to imagine yourself wearing an African princess costume at a Halloween party and actually meeting someone from Africa. Pretty awkward. In Oakland, I'm Malachi Seegers for Marketplace.
Malachi's story was brought to us by our friends at Youth Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Two quick thoughts on the way out today. One, I can't be the only guy out there who objects to another Star Wars movie, right? Hit us on Twitter. Let me know I'm not alone. At Marketplace, APM is the program. At Kai Rizdahl is me. Also, number two, don't forget Frontline tonight, our television documentary about the private and hidden financing of American politics since Citizens United. It's called Big Sky, Big Money. Set your DVRs, or better yet, watch it live. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. The U.S. markets were closed for the day today. The New York Stock Exchange announced late this afternoon it is officially going to open up tomorrow. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.